And welcome back to Tech Radio featuring the Computer Guys. We've gathered the experts to talk tech today and answer questions you might have. In the studios of KCSD in Sioux Falls today, Matt Guru, Joel Brovelite is here. Hey, Joel.
Hey, how you doing?
I am wonderful, sir. John T. Meyer took the week off. He's, working with clients, as you would expect.
Working.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's totally cool. But Exigent Solutions Security Officer Amos Aesop is here, took the lunch hour with us.
Love to be here.
We appreciate that. And, of course, from the Bureau and Peer, Jeff Litterick joins us. Jeff, we have a host of things I want to talk to you about today, not the least of which is a bunch of hacking stuff and then maybe some gaming stuff to throw in. I don't know. How are things in Peer?
Pretty good. And, yeah, there's some important news coming out today about some stores, every single point of sale in all their chains in both Canada and the U.S. being hacked. So,
Is that the Eddie Bauer thing?
Yep. So
let's go ahead and let's just start with that.
So, if you have made a purchase at an Eddie Bauer store anywhere in the United States or Canada, this does not include their online website. In the past, basically since the beginning of 2016, you probably want to watch your statements pretty carefully because Eddie, they suffered a what they call a computer intrusion that put malware on every single point of sale machine. And what we mean by point of sale is that's the cash register. That's the device that you're swiping your credit card or debit card through. So all their point of sale machines were compromised, and all their credit cards used like that were compromised along with them since the beginning of 2016. So, and this is probably the biggest because it affected every single store. Target was pretty big, but it was most stores, but not every single one, if I remember right. This is every single one in the United States and Canada was infected. So the only safe Eddie Bauer purchase in the last year was really their online website.
Okay. Help me put this a little bit into perspective. First, a question. So this was actually the Trojan or the thing was actually in the store. It wasn't back at the home office.
Yeah, the intruders broke into their network and planted the malware. Just like we talk about ransomware and stuff, all these point-of-sale machines, they may not look like it in some cases, but they are all just standard computers running standard OSs. And the malware was set up to four point-of-sale machines to be installed on them and to steal all the credit card and financial transactions happening through those devices. So, there's specialized malware, just like we talk about ransomware being kind of specialized in ransomware. There's specialized malware just to infect point-of-sale machines that retailers use to steal all the financial transactions, credit card data, PIN numbers on debit cards, and so on.
What do I do if I've made a transaction in an Eddie Bauer store at the mall? Do I contact my bank? Does the bank contact me? Where do I go from here?
If the bank detects fraud, they will contact you. What you need to do is be hypervigilant, and Eddie Bauer, like Target, may offer identity theft protection for people. We don't know that yet. But even if they don't, you need to watch the statement carefully. And the second you see a charge that you know you did not make or suspicious, you need to be calling your credit card company and reporting it, telling them that, yes, you did use your credit card at Eddie Bauer, and they will then take the appropriate steps to reverse the payment and issue you a new card.
Okay. Again, for perspective, this type of a hack, so they spread this, was it an infection, I guess, is a Trojan?
Yeah, it's same kind of malware you get on your home machines. This one is just designed to steal financial transactions. Some people on their machines get ones that impersonate banks and take over their browser to their bank and steal their online banking information. It's just another kind of class of malware. It's actually fairly common malware, fairly easy to obtain malware by hackers in order to do this. You have to remember, it's just, and we were having a discussion internally at here in the state about the Internet of Things. And the most important thing to remember about the entire Internet of Things is everything is a computer. Just like your desktop, everything can be infected, everything can be hacked. There is no operating system that cannot be hacked that is perfectly unhackable and does not have malware out for it now. So every, you know, point-of-sale machines, they may not look like a computer, but they are a computer. And they are just as vulnerable as any other type of computer, same as your desktop that you use at work or at home or your laptop. So your refrigerator that's on the Internet is a computer on the Internet, open to the same things. And you need to take this same type of precautions and just understand that everything is a computer. Everything on the is hackable that is a computer.
Well, and you know, the first thing Joel's going to say is, you know, this is, you know, this is scary news, but it's not likely to happen. And I was just literally reading an article about somebody's got a smart electrical socket and it leaks. Oh, you've got one. I don't know if you've got this IoT smart electrical socket in your home.
No, I don't have
okay.
that brand.
So this brand is IoT, but they figured out it, if you go in and actually sign into the thing and do all the things you're supposed to do, it's very easy for hackers. It's so poorly coded that it allows the attackers to hijack the device with a very simple command injection in the password field, and then they can get, you know, all the things you've put in there. So if you put in your social accounts or your email or whatever, passwords and things like that, especially the password to your Wi-Fi and other things, they can literally turn your socket in your house into, have it do like DDoS attacks on people. And so it sounds far-fetched, but in the real world, they're actually starting to do these things.
Yeah.
And so...
In fact, one of the biggest DDoSes recently was by printers,
we
not by computers.
Define what
there was
that
a
is.
Botnet. A group of hackers took over 2 to 3 million printers and used them in a DDoS attack.
So, do you want to take that one, or do you want Jeff to explain what a DDoS attack is?
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Jeff,
okay.
What's a DDoS attack?
Let me describe what a DDoS attack is. A DDoS attack is basically any type of hacking attack that is a denial of service, i.e. to take you off the Internet, to make your connection slow, to cause your computer to crash. Those are all what we term denial of service, right? You lose the ability to use your Internet connection or your computer. The only difference between a DOS attack and a DDoS attack is the DDoS means it's distributed, which means... in a normal DDoS attack, one computer attacks you. In a DDoS attack, it's not one computer. It can be thousands to millions of computers all attacking you at once. It amplifies the effect of the attack to make it even worse for you to be able to try to recover or restore service.
So these are other machines trying to communicate. They're just basically saying, hello, 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 and your machine or whatever your device can't think.
Yep, can't keep up. It becomes overloaded. Your Internet connection becomes overloaded. There's too much data coming down it so that you cannot use your Internet connection because it's full of bad data and bad information being sent to you. There's a lot of ways to do a DDoS attack, but in the end result is you are unable to use the service, and that's the end goal.
Is this like the Star Trek episode where the computer takes over and Spock asks the computer to compute pi to the, you know, whatever-th place, and the computer basically fries itself?
Yep, that's a standard DDoS attack, and there are other equivalents just like that all the way back to the 1970s in Unix. You could have it do a fork on the operating system, which basically spans another program, but an empty program. But if you did this 10 million times, the computer would run out of memory and crash. Well, that's a DDoS type attack, a denial of service. So you took the computer down and made it crash so it was unavailable. So, yeah, they've been around forever. The Internet has made them very popular because they're very cheap. I'm not going to give out websites where people can go, but you can actually, if you want to take someone off the Internet and you know their IP address, which is actually pretty easy to get, especially if they're an online gamer or use social media, and you are taking them off the Internet, it's 15 cents an hour, and pretty much they're going to go off until you decide you want to stop paying 15 cents an hour that they're off the Internet. for big size, big corporation stuff, it's a, you know, you can get into the $5 per hour, $15 per hour to get enough bandwidth to take them off the internet entirely.
Which would be illegal, right?
It's very illegal, but it's very cheap. There are websites that do this for you. You basically go to a website, you will pay in bitcoins, you will put in the target IP address, and you will say, I want this to happen for 4 hours or 20 minutes or whatever you're willing to pay for, and you hit a button, and it's done. It's that simple. There is no skill required anymore, and it is a humongous problem for everybody on the internet, ISP, service providers. A lot more automated defenses are coming out to help stop this stuff, but it is a mass problem because it is becoming so cheap.
Amos, I'm a guy or I'm a business that somebody's gotten chapped off at me, and they want to do a distributed denial of service attack on me or my business.
Sure.
One, my internet provider is probably taking the brunt of this as well, right?
Right.
So are there automated systems that recognize attacks like this, and can they do something about it?
Absolutely. So if your internet service provider, and some of them even locally here in town are providing this, if they provide a distributed denial of service attack protection layer, they can mitigate some of that. And there's technology out there that looks for these bad packets and looks for the flood of information that's coming in that they know is not meant for you, and they're able to discard them and basically throw them on the floor and therefore clear up your pipe. The technology is incredibly expensive, and so owning something like that yourself is generally not something most companies can do. And the service provided by your ISP, while not inexpensive, you have to balance that with how much money are you going to lose if your website were to go down, or if you were to not able to, you know, maybe everything you do is on the internet. Maybe you're a web-only kind of venue, and if you're losing thousands or millions of dollars per minute or hour, depending on what you're selling on the internet, you know, maybe it's worth having that service in place for you. If you get into the bigger entities like the Netflix and the Googles and the Amazons and that sort of stuff, the whole idea becomes much more complex because of it's not just one pipe anymore. Now it's tens and hundreds and thousands of different pipes because their websites are distributed and their services are distributed. And so there's other ways of doing that. But for the average Joe here at home, you can probably contact your ISP and they can probably do something for you. Most of them will do it on a contingency basis. In other words, you've got to pay an upfront fee for them to put it in place, and then you may never use it, but it's an insurance policy. And if you feel like it could be a problem, you got to weigh that price tag.
Are there router folks working on something like the Ciscos and the sort of further up the line to mitigate big bursts like this or continuous attacks? Or?
Well, the problem is determining what's
good,
junk,
what's bad, and what's not.
Okay. And so that's the hard part. And so Cisco and the larger the infrastructure folks are not really in the business of policing that sort of stuff on a regular basis or on a continual basis. You need to have these specialized machines that are meant just for that can be put in place for mitigating those sort of circumstances.
We need to take a quick break. I do want to come back and talk a little bit more about Cisco. Because they just patched a zero-day exploit, and it's called Extra Bacon. So, of course, it got my attention, and we're going to talk about that after this quick break. Welcome back to Tech Radio. We've got the experts here to talk tech. We have Joel Brovelite in the studio today, Matt Guru. We have Amos Aesop as well, and Jeff Litterick from the Bureau and Peer, talking a lot about security today, and there's a lot more news. And we want to stick our toe just into a little bit more of that with the DNC hack. It sounds like the same folks are going after now the candidate Trump and the Republican Party. And there was a company that released, they stole and published a set of NSA cyber weapons earlier. And I'm looking for the name of that, what they called themselves, Jeff, and it's not coming to me, but basically Cisco has patched a zero-day exploit that came out in this leak of those NSA hacks.
The Shadow Brokers.
The Shadow Brokers. Ooh. How could I forget that ominous name, the Shadow Brokers? So, Jeff, explain to me just in a little nutshell. We talked about two other hacks. We talked about one that was caused by or is exploited by really poor writing. It was so poorly written with the electrical plug. And then we talked about the hack of Eddie Bauer stores, and I don't know what the deal was there, if it just wasn't, you know, updated security, or there wasn't, weren't watching for the right things, or what the problem was with that hack. But is this different in the way that data was hacked from the DNC, and or do we even know that yet?
Well, how the data was hacked from the DNC until they release a full report is kind of hard to say, because it could be easier, it could have been hard, without knowing the exact message. But the NSA is, you know, another level up. When you get into what is termed state-sponsored cyber warfare, NSA, Iran, Russia, China, they all have state-sponsored cyber warfare divisions. And, in fact, you can even look up the United States one. I think it's under the Air Force, kind of like their Space Command. But when you get into this level of stuff, the sophistication goes up. For example, the Cisco one was against Cisco firewalls, and it basically allowed, if you already had access to an internal computer or access to a computer that the firewall that was allowed to log into the firewall, depending on the firewall setup, it could be in every internal computer or not, you could bypass all the security and get in. And that was a 10-year-old hack, which means the vulnerability had been in every firewall Cisco produced for about 10 years. That's a long time to go undiscovered, right? Because the state-sponsored stuff, they don't notify people that they've discovered a problem, because they're planning to use it for the long term for very sophisticated malware in the future. So they don't ever tell anybody. So it was a 10-year-old vulnerability that basically bypassed all the security on the firewall and let the user get in. And once you're on the firewall, you could see all the traffic going through, and almost all the traffic in your organization goes through that firewall. So it's a pretty serious kind of thing. But those levels are, you know, a different kind of level than you usually get at the stores and maybe the DNC hack and stuff. I doubt that the hacking group could come up with the stuff they stole themselves, but they were able to somehow find the NSA stuff and actually steal it. And then luckily they published it, so now we're fixing all the holes.
Okay. Yeah, I see that, you know, in the political realm. So Snowden, of course, the former National Security Agency employee, whistleblower Edward Snowden, and then there was another former NSA operative or employee, David Attell, are speculating about the leak Monday from Shadow Brokers, saying it's a response to growing tensions between the U.S. and Russia over the hacks of the DNC. And Snowden's basically saying, yeah, the NSA spying tools that are tied to the Russian hack on that is kind of the same ones that are kind of still going around with the new hacks. And, you know, I don't know how he speculates on these things. He says that basically it was likely obtained by somebody with physical access to the NSA secure area that managed to walk out with a USB stick. I mean, that's kind of the way he did it, but I don't know if, you know, I don't know if he knows, or it's just a lot of speculation, or if it's really good speculation.
Yeah, sometimes it's a lot of speculation. This stuff always, in the end, will leak out. This is not the first state-sponsored, and I'm not going to list the states, but if you remember the Iran Sutex worm that affected their centrifuges to make for enriching uranium, that destroyed a whole bunch of them and stuff, that worm and virus, there's been a few others that have been outed over the years. There's a real famous toolkit one that came out that everyone pretty much agrees came out of the NSA because of the sophistication and level of interoperability that's not normally found in other stuff. What happens is everything once used is in the wild, right? Once you've used this hack someplace, if someone does discover it, well, guess what? It's going to get out sooner or later. So you can hold on to these, but if you never use them, it's the only way to never allow them to get out. So it could have been that maybe Russia was keeping a track of ones they had discovered over time that were being used on them or in their country, and it was that list that was released. It wasn't actually stolen directly from the NSA. It was stolen from people who had been watching the NSA and learning and detecting their attacks over time. Remember, this is a 10-year-old hack. They've probably been using it for 10 years. So if someone did discover it, well, maybe they held on to another estate and they compiled a list and gave out. It's really hard to say at this point.
I suppose the closer you keep it to your vest, the less likely it's to be discovered and be patched. So, yeah, kind of keep it quiet.
But the second you use it, if someone out there discovers it, you know, game's up. I mean, that is the problem with cyber warfare is if you really know the good hacks, you can never use them because once you use them, the chances of people discovering them and fixing them are pretty high. So.
Kind of holding your cards till you need to play them. Well, it's an opportunity here for folks to call in and the show, 800-524-3604, the number. Or, of course, you can text us or tweet us or, you know, whatever
Facebook.
You like to do. Facebook. Yeah, facebook.com/techradio.
I'm updating right now.
Well, Amos is out there. Let's ask some questions and get some comments coming in on the show today. At KentSDPB is the Twitter handle if you want to get right to me and the show, at KentSDPB, and that will get a direct line into the show. I wanted to talk to you a little bit today, Joel. It's been 5 years since Tim Cook. I can't believe it. I mean...
Yeah, crazy.
Seems like maybe two and a half years. But Tim Cook took over Apple 5 years ago. Woz had a very public interview that he seems to think things are going pretty darn well.
Yeah, I don't know how you could argue with that. You know, as soon as Tim Cook took over and then just a few months after that, Steve Jobs died, people were saying, well, you know, Apple's not going to be able to innovate. They're not going to be the same company without Steve Jobs there, and truly, it's not the same company because Steve Jobs isn't there. But you know, some of Tim Cook's strengths really have shown through. I mean, he took the company from, I mean, he doubled their revenue from like 100 something billion to 230 billion. Brought their stock to the or brought the company the most valuable company in the world for a period of time. Some other great things that he's done. They're really the only tech company out in Silicon Valley that is has total, I think, very nearly total equity among pay for both men and women. Their diversity is better than Facebook's, Google's, Microsoft's as far as ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation. So they've made lots of strides in that area that I think are really great things that don't show up on the bottom line, but really make it a very admired company.
So is he a genius on the business side, kind of the way Jobs was a genius in design?
Well, he was always the CFO. Well, not always, but he was the CFO for a very long time while Steve was there, maybe almost the entire time, actually. I'd have to look that up. But so he was kind of running that business side anyway.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, Steve did a good job of setting things up. You know, what I will say is, you know, Steve Jobs released some pretty amazing products, and there was some good timing for that. But Tim Cook hasn't introduced anything that has been an abject failure. Everything he's introduced has been either a good seller or a great seller. You know, the iPhone 6, the iPhone 5, both of them, better than the other for sales, all released under him. The Apple Watch, mm-hmm. which is the number one watch on the market. You could say watches are kind of tepid for sales, but they still have the number one in that market share, and we see new ones come out all the time. So they maybe not innovating at the breakneck pace that Steve was doing, but you could say a lot of things about, you know, maybe the time wasn't right for that. Who knows what they're working on now. I do agree with you're talking about the interview with Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple, who's actually still a consultant with Apple. You know, he talked about how the smartphone market, everybody talks about how there's a declining sales throughout the world on that. And Apple plays the long game on all of their products. They don't say, okay, well, we have this one, and then in 2 months they release another one, and then they release one that's, you know, waterproof, and then they'll release another one that does this, another one that has a hidden knife blade in it. They don't do any of that. They yeah.
They, ooh, I like that one with the knife blade.
Yeah, who doesn't really? I want the one with the fork.
Switch blade.
Swiss Army apple.
They really try to make great products for people that really enjoy them, and they try to keep those customers. And without question, Apple customers, as I can attest to, are very loyal because the products they put out are very steady, very reliable, and they're the kind of products that people want to keep buying. So that's their long game on that. And I think the innovation for the mobile phone, we have a lot of room to grow on that, I think. So that's what I think.
Would Apple be where it is today if Windows hadn't kept torquing people off time and time and time again over the years?
It would be different, but I don't know that – it would be hard to separate that, of course. That's a big what if. But no, I mean, Apple has always taken a different path than companies like Microsoft. If there wasn't a Microsoft, there would have been something to fill that space. Maybe things would have been different. Apple is very much a design company first, and a product company second, in my opinion. So I think they would have always been that. I don't think they would have wanted to be the kind of company that put sales figures ahead of creating, you know, beautiful and functional products. I think that is in their DNA, and that continues to be.
And here's my point. So this week, Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, for those who haven't heard of them, they have been from day one of, I guess, sort of technology and the internet, the pioneers of privacy. Am I mischaracterizing that at all? They've kind of been privacy.
As far as Apple?
Well, no, just, I mean, on the internet and keeping people's data private and not, you know, sharing everything out with everybody. Just being the watchdog for privacy.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, is kind of what I'm trying to say. So they've wrote a very lengthy critical blog post this week that talks about Microsoft blatantly disregarding, and there's their words, user choice and privacy when it comes out to Windows 10, when they're talking about Windows 10. So they said that Windows 10 sends an unprecedented amount of usage data back to servers in Redmond, back to Microsoft, and they're not happy about it. They're saying these are privacy failings, and it's not the first time.
Yeah, and it's not the first company to do that. You know, you bring up a really good point. One of the other things I meant to talk about with Apple under Tim Cook, Apple went from every other company, you know, taking data and, you know, using it for whatever they wanted to being kind of the envy of the entire tech industry for the standard for privacy on data. They don't keep anybody's data. They went so far as to challenge the U.S. government on not unlocking a phone. I mean, you can say what you want about that, but they're very cognizant. And that was all under Tim Cook. But getting to your question about Microsoft and sending data back and forth, you know, we talked about this when the court case was coming up with Apple and unlocking that phone. This is going to shake out to where people are going to decide whether they want their privacy and they want their data kept to them, or whether they don't care so much about their data, they're not worried about it, and they would just rather have, you know, convenient products at attractive prices, and they're going to decide with their wallet. And honestly, it seems like they are deciding with their wallet, frankly.
I have seen prompts on my Mac asking me if it's okay to send usage data back to, you know, the mothership or whatever, and you get a choice there. Mm-hmm. So either yes or no, this is, and I'm assuming they're going to use the data to improve
and
the
you
product.
And you can go back and re-decide later to not do that. It's not buried.
Or
it's,
do it.
Yeah. I mean, you can decide, like, I say yes today, but tomorrow I can go turn that off. And it's very easy to do in Windows. If you're even given the option, it's not so easy to go find and redo that situation.
And I take the sort of the voting booth approach when I get prompts like that. If it's something I don't know about, I usually click no and then move on. And like you say, you can go back and revisit it later if it's something that you really feel strongly about. But it's just one of those things. And that was kind of the point of my question was, is Apple making the privacy such a forefront in their product and sticking with it, possibly increasing their sales?
Well, I think it's probably maybe on the margins increasing their sales. I don't know that they make privacy and protecting your data the number one priority at the company, no matter what they say. They do seem to make it more of a priority than any of their competition. I think there are privacy groups that would like to see them protected even more. There are other things that could be done to protect your data and make sure that nobody else can access it, things that Apple haven't done, or maybe the technology is not good enough to yet. But I guess we'll see on that. But definitely, I think they have made it a feature ever, well, since about a year before that whole scandal with, not I wouldn't call it a scandal, between that lawsuit between the U.S. government and Apple for unlocking that phone.
Right. Well, while we're talking about Apple, do we have any Apple news? I've got people asking me about the iPhone 7.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Asking about the iPhone 7 when the iPhone 6 Plus came on. So,
yeah,
you know, there's lots of rumors. We could talk all day, but, you know, in probably about the next show or the show after that, we'll have some more maybe believable rumors. I think the idea is that it's going to be thinner yet, and they're probably going to get rid of the headphone jack. I think those two things are pretty solid. I think we'll probably see another smaller phone again.
How's all the in-out going to work on that then? Is it all going to be Bluetooth? Or
it'll continue to be Bluetooth as much as it is. This is, of course, my theory. I don't have any solid info on that. There's really no reason we need to have an analog audio output on a device anymore. We haven't really needed one for something like 10 years. In fact, most of your audio out is converted digitally and then sent out analog in the phone. And that's just kind of extra horsepower that's not needed.
But it's always been a really convenient way to get stuff in. And I think of journalists that have the microphones that
plug
it in.
But see, how do you get it in? There's no audio in on a phone, and there hasn't been, I don't know, ever on the iPhone.
Right. You use the headphone jack. To plug the microphone plugs into the headphone jack, and you do the interview.
There's not a separate audio in. Yeah. Well, that doesn't change at all. You just plug in if you need to use an analog input. This is just a done deal. There are already USB to audio to like stereo mini or mono audio plugs out there. So it wouldn't be USB. They would just make one to go in the Lightning connection. It would just be a digital input, and you would either plug in a direct digital, like a Lightning audio headphone thing, or you would just have a little adapter that would plug in. And for the 5 to 1% of people that would actually need that, and I think that's probably about it, that's going to be, you know, maybe a $15 purchase, and they'll grudgingly buy that, and they'll grumble about it.
Yeah.
But they'll be happy that their phone is thinner and more resistant to the audio cutting out because you got just a little water on your plug before you put it in there. I think it's all upside, no downside for that.
I'm just thinking of the people that swipe credit card, that use the little thing to plug into the headphone.
Sure, that'll just plug into the total digital port. And those, yeah, I mean, just
probably a myriad of
there's
devices.
If they drug along every old port from the 80s, which that one is, we'd still have parallel on our phones. I mean, it's just at some point we have to move forward, people. Just move with us.
And at this point, we need to move forward with another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about batteries. And it may sound boring, but it's a little exciting if they go up in flames, either near you or in something you're driving. But we'll get to that right after this. And welcome back to Tech Radio. We have the tech experts in the studio today. Jeff Litterick at the Bureau in Pierre. We have Amos Aesop here at the studios of KCSD in Sioux Falls, along with Joel Brovelite. Thanks for joining us today, guys. You can interface with us if you'd care to. 1-800-524-3604, the phone number. A simpler way, send us an email. Midday@sdpb.org is a quick way to tap out a message to us and ask a question or make a comment about any of the topics today. We have a lot of phone carrier stuff to get to. And Amos, you didn't get your Note 7 today?
It's on the truck to be delivered, but I haven't got it yet.
It's not physically here yet, no. So we've got that, we've got a lot of phone things to deal with. But you came across an interesting MIT article about battery life.
Well, you know, many, many years ago, I had read an article about why batteries were not keeping up with technology and why with the advancement of, and when I say many years ago, I'm talking 15, 20 years ago, why batteries were still at the sizes they were, why they held such minimal charges, why, and the thought process there was that it was a conspiracy theory by Duracell and those folks to make you continue to buy batteries, right?
Okay.
Because if they made longer lasting batteries. Well, actually now it turns out that while not directly related, but MIT has found a way of doubling power. And of course, batteries have improved, right? With the new types of batteries. In fact, you've got an interesting one on the lithium polymer batteries that are not the alkaline type that you would buy from Duracell or whoever. But MIT is capable of doubling battery power for consumer electronics and making smaller ones and allowing them to run for a longer time, which is going to be great for everything that we use these days, whether it's your Bluetooth headset that you need to use with your new iPhone or your cell phone or your drone or whatever device you happen to be putting in. We need more power in smaller spaces, and hopefully what MIT is coming out with will help with that.
Yeah, I love the consumer devices that let you plug it into the wall and charge it, and then you can take it with you and charge other things with it.
Mm-hmm.
So if your phone goes low or your Bluetooth headset or you need extra power on the road and you're out in the middle of nowhere, you can recharge your stuff. I've seen them now because I've been looking again. They make there was such capacity you can actually jumpstart your car from these little things.
I have one of those.
You do?
Uh-huh.
Is it as small as they say it is?
It's pretty small, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
it's got
that
kind of horsepower.
It's not, it's not the kind that you would, cold crank a battery at 10 below zero. It's not that kind of thing.
Right.
But if you need a boost, yeah, it totally works.
That's amazing. And here's my, I guess what I'm leading to here is we see battery issues in the news. There was the latest was the Happy Meal. Did you see that? The battery in the watch that comes with it
gets hot.
Gets hot and burned a kid, and
oh,
so they've
nice.
They've recalled the Happy Meals that have this sports tracker watch or whatever they're calling
sure.
it or whatever. And there have been the guy that got burned by his iPhone. Did you see that? The whole back of his pants was burned off, and here's where I'm going with this: is I've been researching a drone, buying one. And in the list of accessories for these things is, it looks like a little lunch pail, a little zip-up lunch pail, but it's a flame-proof thing that you put your batteries in when you charge them overnight so you don't set your house on fire when these things take off and burn.
I don't want to live in the world that you're talking about.
And people are taking pictures. They're saying, this thing, it's an $11 thing you buy, and it's saving their houses because their houses aren't going up in flames in the middle of the night.
Or fire alarm. You could have one of those little things that tell you when there's a fire.
Yeah, but I'd rather contain it to a thing the size of a lunchbox myself.
That seems like the backward way. I'm sorry, but that seems like a terribly backward way to fix the problem. I know. Instead of improving battery technology, let's give everybody a safe box for their phone.
Such
an unusable device.
It's not that, though. It's not like they're manufacturing batteries that are dangerous and they know are going to cause fires, and therefore you have to put them in these asbestos bags. There's just so many batteries that are made, and there's volatile chemicals inside them. And between the charge and discharge, someone's probably going to get something.
Yeah, or
that isn't
or who knows?
Right.
Yeah, there's just like it's a device. I mean,
what if we had a news story on every battery that worked well? You just couldn't. You only hear about the ones that explode and burn people's pants off and burn people's houses down.
When I used to mow the lawn at my parents' house, we had a gas can that was just a gas can that had a spout that you poured the gas in and poured it out. It wasn't safe at all. And it just leaked gas all over the place. That is way safer than any lithium, way less safe than any lithium battery. And if you go around to people's houses, you'll find cans just like that. So you can buy the scary box, but no one else needs to buy that.
But if you're going to take that gas can and put it near an open flame, I hope you put it in this bag. It's the act of the charging or introducing that chemical reaction that causes the problem. And again, it's such a minor or such a small number of devices that this happens to.
It's smaller than a small number. I'll bet there are fewer than I'm not even going to guess. I bet there are more accidents with coconuts than there are with fires.
With LiPo batteries?
Yeah. I bet there are.
Still, if you're doing it, you might as well take the precaution.
I guess.
I did find them actually cheaper on Amazon. You'll never
use that. Yeah.
They have the, which is weird, they call them a LiPo for a lithium polymer.
Right.
They got the LiPo bags. For $4.40.
Goodness.
That's half the price of what I was going to pay.
Hey, Amazon's got everything.
You know, I mean, I will say, having said that, when I charge my phone or any other device, and this is just a good tip for anybody, don't charge it like in a blanket. I've seen that. Don't charge it in your coat.
Right.
Put it on a flat surface that there's some vent on it. Because what happens, and this always happens, your device will get warm if it's put in some place that will keep it warm, because as it charges, it generates heat. We all know that because of physics, because power.
Right.
So when you charge things, it should be on a flat surface. It should be on a safe surface, like a countertop, whatever. Don't put it on fabric. Don't put it in between something. Don't stack papers on top of it. That's just common sense. Just like when you spill gas on the ground, don't smoke around it. I mean, those are all common sense things.
Do you unplug your charger when you're not charging your phone?
No.
I don't either.
No. But you know what I don't do? And I yell at my daughter about this. I don't leave the cable that charges laying on the ground or laying over where it could, short out. That's actually what I worry about, is it shorting out either the outlet or the charger. Now, I don't actually worry about it causing a fire, because that's just so rare. More likely you're going to short the charger out. But I don't leave those cables all sitting around. They're on a desk or on a countertop where they don't touch anything, But you're right. I mean, when you get done charging them, you're supposed to unplug them. That is the best way to do it.
What I worry about, because I tend to buy the cheapest charger I can buy.
You worry about a lot.
And, they price it. I just imagine these factories.
You're going to buy the cheapest charger possible, but then you buy a bag to put your stuff into. Maybe just put it together by a good charger.
You know, I think that I think we could look at the numbers for battery fires caused that happen to be in a certain model of car, and that's going to be a little bit higher, right? The Teslas seem to be.
Well,
hot.
At least
hot,
one
hot,
did.
Hot. Right.
In France, do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, well, so there was somebody out for a test drive in France, and there were four people in the car, one of which was actually a Tesla employee. The story doesn't really explain why there was a Tesla employee as opposed to a, standard car salesperson, but I guess it could be somebody from the car shop. Anyway, they were going around a corner. They heard a loud noise. A warning message popped up on the screen. The Tesla employee said, "You should stop the car and we should get out." And then within just a couple minutes, the entire car was engulfed in flames. So,
and there are photos of this on the internet, and it's not a pretty sight.
That's right. Yeah. And so luckily, it wasn't somebody's personal vehicle that was destroyed. It was one that had not been bought and was being tested, but batteries, who knew?
Clearly there's more safety precautions to be done.
Yeah, again, though, I mean, what have they shipped, 500,000, I think, units, Tesla, and they've got orders for twice that many more. I mean,
you're saying odds are it's never going to happen to you.
I'm saying it's just like any other thing, including gasoline-powered vehicles.
And Amos is saying there's so many of these made, odds are it's going to happen.
He's absolutely right.
No, I'm not saying it's going to happen.
It's going to happen somewhere to someone.
Just like anything else. Right.
No, and that's true.
Right.
But you've got to mitigate those with actual numbers.
Right.
Not every battery is going to light on fire. Some batteries are going to light on fire, just like you are probably going to get hail damage on your car. No, you're not. Probably you might.
Somebody
this
will.
Is all a chance.
All right, all right. Well, we got a little bit of phone news we have to talk about.
Real quick, too, though, Tesla's, speaking of the batteries, new Tesla battery charger, if you previously plugged your car in through the cord, an hour of charge would get you about 52 miles. Now they've got the wireless version, which, just like your phone, is a little bit slower charging. You get 20 miles on an hour of charge there. $2,500 for a new charger, so if you're...
But, imagine you don't have to plug anything
convenience,
in.
That convenience. Yeah, right.
Well, that would be... like drive into your garage
driving
and drive over it and charges?
Boy.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The new world's coming.
All right. I've seen a lot of ads for unlimited data. I think T-Mobile was the latest for people that want to opt into that. You
Which, by the way, isn't unlimited data. Everybody knows this.
They just slow it
they
down.
They slow you down after they get to the unlimited part. So it's unlimited, but...
And no HD video streaming and no hotspot.
Read the fine print.
Because AT&T Wednesday was rolling out a new data plan that does away with overage fees, but it reduces your data, so you don't get the fees now. Mm-hmm. I guess so. Good news, I guess, for consumers.
You know, I don't know what the number is, but I'm going to take a wild guess here. I would say for 85 to 90% of people, to them, that will be unlimited data. To them, that will be, they're not using their hotspot. They won't notice the difference between HD and standard definition streaming. And 26 gigs is a lot of data to use in a month. And, you know, I know there's people out there who use it for more than that. They stream all day long, audio or video. But for the average consumer, to them, this is going to appear to be unlimited data.
If you're running out of data in your current plan, this may help.
it may.
As someone that does that, you know, I have to watch the last couple of days of my contract because I'm starting to get text messages that I'm getting close to the end of my data. This may be a boost. So,
out of curiosity, how much data do you use in a month?
We're brushing up against 18 gig right now.
Okay. And do you share that with multiple people?
Yes, I do.
Okay. How about you? Just as I take over the show here.
We this month wound up using almost 24 gigs.
Wow.
See, I'm about to go to the XXL plan or whatever that they go, it's
but
up to 24.
I should say that's about 8 gig more than ever, but that's solely because of the Olympics.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I'm just thankful they don't charge for text messages.
But it's fine with me because we don't have cable TV. We don't pay $120 a month. So when we pay $40 extra, which is what it's going to cost us for that data, we're still money ahead.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I look at it.
Interesting perspective.